court would clearly note that Justice Sabers and Justice Konenkamp have disqualified themselves and declares appointed the Honorable Lori Wilbur, presiding judge of the Sixth Judicial Circuit, to sit in this matter. As we usually do in disciplinary cases, even though this is a show cause, the state disciplinary board will proceed first for 20 minutes, then the attorney has 20 minutes, and Mr. Lewis, we usually invite the attorney to make a personal statement before the court if he chooses to do so during that time, so you may wish to reserve part of your time.
Yes,
sir. Okay, and then there's a 10-minute reply by the state disciplinary board. You may proceed, Mr. Fieber.
Counsel, Mr. Reynolds. As I mentioned to Mr. Lewis at the chance to visit with him a minute ahead of the proceedings this morning, I've been doing this for 8 years on behalf of the board, and I spent 3 years as a board member. And this is one of the most inexplicable situations I think that I have personally encountered. And I think the board's actions in dealing with Mr. Reynolds over the past 3 to 3.5 years evidences that in the materials that was submitted in our findings and recommendations and in the petition for temporary suspension. Let me also say at the outset that since July 25th, I think, was when the order of temporary suspension was entered by this court. I have been advised, or the board has been advised, that on July 28th, Mr. Reynolds appeared before the Circuit Court in Pennington County in a matter involving Great Bear, or Bear Country. That's in 708-164.
You're saying he appeared in Circuit Court as an attorney after he was suspended?
That's what I've been advised. That's correct. I also received a complaint from James Nelson, an attorney in Rapid City, who had been retained by Tatanka, which is Dunbar, to try to set aside the default judgment that is mentioned in the findings that we filed with the court. And then on August 21, I received a complaint from Richard Johnson, attorney in Sioux Falls, who was representing Mrs. Reynolds in a divorce proceeding, who forwarded to me some information which indicated that federal income tax returns for 2005 and 2006, I believe, had been produced in the course of discovering the divorce proceeding, and Mrs. Reynolds had taken them to CPA in Rapid City by the name of Thorstenson, apparently to make some inquiry about the returns. Mr. Thorstenson advised Attorney Johnson that his firm did not prepare them, that it was not his signature on the return, and that the ID numbers and so on that go on those returns were not correct. I promptly provided this to Mr. Reynolds when I received it, and to his counsel once I knew that Mr. Lewis had made an appearance. So I just wanted to tell you that I felt obliged to do so, and I understand that he has not had a chance to respond to these items. The board has not conducted any further investigation, obviously, because it just came to our attention, but it seemed to me that it was something that needed to be disclosed to the court and to Mr. Reynolds. As the board has struggled with what to do in this particular series of events, it's pretty obvious that from the outset, Mr. Leonard's conduct was viewed as an aberration when the first complaint was made in, I think, March, or perhaps earlier than 2005, because he had a very good reputation as a good mayor, as a nice person. He made a very winsome and honest appearance before the board, very convincing, and the board felt that he was overlooked, probably stressed out, which happens to many attorneys, as we all know. And so I began a process of trying to, with the firm that he was then in, work out a way to get his cases managed properly, to get some peer review from one of his partners, and to, you know, get his life straightened out, his practice going in the right way. And since that time, it's been a constant series of attempts to achieve that goal, and all of which have failed. And the board scheduled another, the last hearing in June in Rapid City to inquire about a number of things, including violation of the Private 60 agreement that Mr. Reynolds had entered into with the board. He failed to show up. And that was about the time the board became aware of this default judgment that had occurred out in, I think, the 7th Circuit. So the board felt, without having any response from him, the lawyers had happened, a significant amount of money was involved, and he had come up to the board and he was playing for it to appear, to respond, to do anything. The board felt that we ought to ask for temporary suspension, understanding their obligations to protect.
Why he was failure to appear in front of you at this last hearing at the Bar Convention, do you know how many times he was in front of the board and your attempts to work with him?
Well, yes, we had four hearings, one of which he didn't appear.
Okay.
There were three of which he appeared, and there were numerous letters back and forth, phone calls. And, Your Honor, Tom Nicholson was, as you know, the board assigns a member as the primary investigator in each case, and Tom was the primary person in the Reynolds matter from the outset. And he just did everything he possibly could, I think, to try to salvage what everyone thought had been a very promising career.
Was it the board that asked Mr. Palmer to be the mentor? Mr. Palmer?
The board certainly approved that. I can't recall exactly whether Mr. Reynolds suggested Mr. Palmer or not, but somewhere in that interchange, yes, that's what happened. And of course, that didn't work either, as it turned out. So, I can't say much more than what's been submitted on behalf of the board. If you have other questions, I'd be glad to answer them. I'll hear what Mr. Bruce and Mr. Lance have to say. If I have some response, I'll come back.
All right, and I understand that ordinarily there's a written response filed here. We don't have one, so we'll give you a little latitude when you come back up, because it'll be the first time you've heard it, I assume.
Right, that's correct, Your Honor.
All right. Any questions for Mr. Friedland from the court? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Mr. Rose.
Thank you, Your Honor. And may it please this court, Mr. Friedland. Mr. Chief Justice, I am here proudly on behalf of my colleague and friend, Mr. Reynolds. These are unique proceedings, and I'd like to address some of the matters that Mr. Freeburg brought up. I also have at my side Mr. Reynolds, who certainly can speak to any questions that this court may have. What we're here today is to address this court's order to show cause why there should not be a disbarment of a lawyer who I consider to be extremely talented, was a mentor of mine, and I think has a prospect of a career that is very much worth salvaging. Mr. Chief Justice, you were certainly curious about the timing of this court suspension and any practice that might have taken place after that time. And just so the record is clear, the materials provided by the disciplinary board denotes a certified mailing received by my client on the 30th of July, signed for, and I think the allegation that Mr. Freeburg made was that there was an appearance on the 28th of July, 2 days before he would have had notice of the suspension. For the court's edification, there has been no practice whatsoever from and after the date of, according to the records, he received notice. There has been no destruction of any files. There's been no further practice of law. If the court would indulge me just a little background, in 1996, after a two-year clerkship with Judge Berg in Rapid City, I joined a law firm of what I considered to be giants in the practice of law in South Dakota. These lawyers included Terry Quinn and Ken Barker and Greg Easland and some wonderful, wonderful lawyers. As it turned out, I developed the bulk of my skills and what I took forward from that firm by practicing near and with Mr. Reynolds. He was a young partner in that firm, really more a contemporary of my age, but I was immediately struck by the level of cases that he was handling, partly by necessity, because he worked in an area of complex litigation that, frankly, was not particularly well-developed in South Dakota in the mid-90s. I observed personally the dedication that he would put forth to his clients, the dedication that he expressed towards the bar, the incredible hard work and ethical conduct I saw on a first-hand basis. The other thing that I was struck by is oftentimes, because it was a developing area of law, even with the combined experience of very good lawyers, Mr. Reynolds would oftentimes be handling these cases sort of on point as a 30-something young lawyer against other giants in the field, the Tom Waltz of the world, and Ed Carpenters, and others, attorneys from Chicago and New York, who really could try to put you to their paces. I personally observed Lanston v. Shaver, Odell v. Brock, Hayes v. Northern Hills General Hospital, Estate of Elliott, Parker v. Western Dakota Insurers, Wheeler v. Cedar Shore Resort. These have become sort of the seminal cases in South Dakota on a number of topics, but the kind of work that Mr. Reynolds was tasked to do were for people that really needed help, minority shareholders, people in employment discrimination cases, ADA cases. He tried to advance these types of causes. These cases have helped not just these clients, but lawyers practicing and judges ruling on decisions. You can't look at a minority shareholder client in a counseling situation without referring to the work that Mr. Reynolds and others have done to develop this area of law. I mention it primarily for this reason. The sheer volume of good work that this lawyer has done on behalf of clients and the bar, and I should mention, he spoke at bar convention meetings. He's tried to serve the bar. Just the sheer volume of good work that he's done as compared to some of the more difficult situations that we find ourselves in today, I think begs for at least caution as we proceed, given the very harshest of remedies that is presently before the court. One additional indulgence of background. I also, as a young lawyer, was able to observe Mr. Reynolds both as a family man, as a leader in the community, and I can tell you that he's presently sitting on community service boards in Rapid City, has done it throughout his time there, and I think it's worth mentioning, particularly in cases where we're here before this court on maybe not your finest hour, but no lawyer should be judged by the most difficult of situations.
That's not what got him here, though. Let's talk about what got him here.
Let's do it. If we could focus on this court's order, and I'd like to and in not in any way to diminish the initial findings of fact and conclusions of law set forth by the board. But we've got a collection of 13 findings of fact. Truly, Your Honor, the first nine of which I think have already been sort of addressed by the board. We've got two complaints. There's a record on these complaints. There's a history with the disciplinary board. And, you know, those things have already been dealt with. So what we're down to is the failure to appear at the state bar's hearing. And frankly, some of these newer matters, I think this court would properly recognize there's no record whatsoever. We have, in fact, received the communication that the bar was provided, or the disciplinary committee was provided. The tax return issue, there's been no discovery in the divorce. So whatever happened in terms of the tax returns, the record is just not developed. The failure to appear, Your Honor, was taken very seriously by Mr. Reynolds. Fortunately or unfortunately, we're dealing here with a case where there is a history that we can judge whether or not, or how to judge this failure to appear. What Mr. Reynolds will tell this court and tell the disciplinary board in the instant this court deems fit to engage a referee is that he simply did not receive notice of the hearing in Rapid City, did not know that it was happening, did not knowingly fail to appear. And while it has a dog ate my homework air to it, I'd ask the court to please keep in mind that we do have a history here of appearing pursuant to the board's own paperwork three different times. Now, this is a Rapid City lawyer that appears once in Sioux Falls, twice in Pierre. I think Mr. Friedberg can confirm that there was an additional trip to Chamberlain, South Dakota, for an update on the status of Mr. Reynolds' files. There's a history of written responses. There's a history of compliance when a mentor was suggested. There is a history of, at least for a time, before he took an in-house position, of reporting, where the board, and I think Mr. Reynolds will agree, he was severely overtaxed in terms of what any reasonable lawyer could do to advance his files. The board, I believe, at some point required sort of quarterly or maybe more frequently reporting. There's a history of complying with that obligation. And so while in other situations it may seem a little questionable that he simply didn't receive notice of the hearing, in this case, we're at least informed by the fact that over the past couple of years, he's very diligently appeared, taking these matters very seriously, and does so today. When the the Dunbar situation referenced in finding the fact 10. Now, this is a new complaint. It is not a new substantive issue. I mean, this is a years-old substantive matter to which Mr. Reynolds has not had an opportunity to respond to the disciplinary board. But it's not like he defaulted 2 weeks ago. The same time frame that resulted in the earlier complaints, this is in the same time frame.
Well, you know, I find this argument a little difficult to accept. Even if he didn't get the notice of the hearing, the board enters findings of fact. No response from your client. The board requests a suspension with the Supreme Court. No response from your client. He's suspended. No response from your client. There's a consistent pattern of no response. So you're asking us to accept that he would have been there with bells on if he'd known that the disciplinary board was going to have a hearing?
I certainly can represent to the court that he would have appeared before that hearing. The procedural part of the Chief Justice's comments, I think, bears addressing. The findings of fact were submitted on, and I think this was recognized by Justice Sabers. The findings of fact are submitted and copies are provided. Per the specific language, the findings ask that Mr. Reynolds admit or deny within 30 days. At the same time, the petition for temporary suspension comes in. These are both dated July 14, 2008. Now, before the 30 days expires, this court entered the order of suspension and ordered Mr. Reynolds to appear before this court to show cause. I think it's uniquely situated, at least procedurally, in that he didn't have the 30 days, and I hope that we can be mindful that really all the board was looking for was for Mr. Reynolds to admit or deny the allegations regarding, at that time, just the Tatanka default situation, and that if he denied at all, the only thing the board was requesting is that the matter be placed in the hands of a referee to make a further record. And I think that's all we're here to ask the court to do. It seems that, and certainly the court has the authority to jump in, issue this order of suspension, has the authority to make Mr. Reynolds and I show cause that he shouldn't be disbarred. And I think at that point, the response was, we've been ordered to appear, and we're going to appear. And but per the board's own, first of all, the petition did the same thing. The petition asked this court to send the matter to a referee so that we can develop a further record. And this court is well acquainted with the standards for disbarment, which require that there is clear evidence that the protection of the public warrants this very extreme action. Now, I'm not sure that that means clear and convincing evidence, but the word clear must mean something, that there is a clear showing that the public needs the protection, and I just don't think that we have it on this particular record. Mr. Reynolds should be held accountable and answer for the Tatanka issues, and he's prepared to do that. He should also be accountable and at least speak to the referee about why he didn't show up for the June hearing, because as this court knows, that in and of itself can be grounds for discipline. But for the board to cite, correctly, for that proposition, in Ray Rude, I would just ask that the court consider the extreme circumstances in the Rude case where there was just a simple, knowing dereliction of responding to the board. And in this case, at least the argument that he did not receive notice and didn't appear despite having a long history of appearing. I'm not sure if I mentioned it, but with respect to the tax returns, I don't believe either the board submission or whatever record there is would support the idea that any tax returns were filed as part of any discovery. We're prepared to address the tax return issue should this court indulge the matter for further record in front of the referee, but there certainly has not been any formal discovery in Mr. Reynolds' divorce. And that's something he's prepared to answer to as well. But I just don't think the record, as a matter of fundamental fairness or due process, would allow this court to consider something that's just at this point no more than an accusation in its ruling.
Let me ask you something procedurally. I want to make sure I understand. The board's formal findings were signed on the 2nd of July, I believe. And when were they received? Or when is the return receipt in the fairly received?
There's three dates, Your Honor, that are important. They were signed on July 2nd. The certificate of service is dated July 9th. And the receipt for the materials is July 14th. Interestingly,
so the 30 days has expired to respond.
The 30 days, as I believe Justice Sabers indicated when the 30 days was per that record, which would have been the 11th of August 2008. And I think
what I'm saying is we don't have a response today, and it's the end of August.
I understand, Your Honor. These are very unique proceedings. When the show cause order came from this court, suspension of show cause, I think the thought was the jurisdiction, if you will, of the disciplinary board, that ship is sailed. Maybe there is no proceeding until such time as we appear.
Right, but the statute requires a response with this court, does it not?
The statute requires a response.
And I know that the temporary suspension required a response, I believe within 10 days.
See, I read the statute that a request for a temporary suspension requires a response within 10 days. The court entered the suspension order.
Okay.
I'm not sure if it was the 10 days or not, but we jumped at least a couple steps ahead. And, Your Honor, as I read the statute, and I could be wrong, as I read the statute, once this court suspended, there really wasn't the opportunity to respond.
But then what about response on the merits, on the findings and recommendations? Is that forthcoming?
Well, it certainly can be, and if the court would indulge it, absolutely. Again, I read the same statute on temporary suspension as once this court entered its order suspending, and to show cause why you shouldn't be disbarred, it would be a little futile to send something into the disciplinary board.
But back to the formal findings, it's not futile to respond to those.
Well, I understand.
And we sit here today, we don't know what your position is. The only reason we knew you were coming was because you called us. You called the clerk. The bar doesn't know what your position is, and now you're today asking for more hearings. This is not the way we do business here.
I understand the court's frustration. To the extent that the position on the merits, if this is, you know, akin to trying to set aside a default judgment, I mean, if we're needing to show a defense on the Tatanka default, and Mr. Reynolds has been deposed in that case, he's explained the situation. That is, he did answer the complaint. He did file a counterclaim. At that point, he took a position, his in-house position, and didn't hear anything further about the case. He should be made to answer to those things. But that's sort of the timeline about what the position would be. And let's keep in mind, and I think that, Mr. Chief Justice, you're honed in on the issue. It's Tatanka, and it's the failure to appear. And, you know, a disbarment, I'm not going to minimize those things at all, but a disbarment under, really, that's sort of what the issues are at this point. I think it's extreme. And I think because of just the volume of good work that this lawyer has done and the prospect that he can continue to assist the clients and the bar, that there is no harm in developing the record further, particularly with this court having a suspension that is being honored to the letter. And so the public is protected.
I still don't understand. If he wants to assert a defense to Tatanka, and he wants to assert a defense to failure to appear before the board, then why wasn't an answer filed within 30 days?
If we're talking about the substantive
on the substantive
Tatanka issue, the disciplinary issue with Tatanka, or the legal lawsuit involving Tatanka, the disciplinary
response to these findings, the response to the board's findings and recommendation.
All I can say, Your Honor, is that Mr. Reynolds is prepared to do so, but took this court's order of suspension in order to show cause as essentially you're standing down until such time as you can appear. That's where we were. And I may have misread the statute, and for that, that's my fault.
It's just with the history of not appearing, with the history here, like, I forgot what your phrase was before, the dog ate the homework. Okay.
But that's unique. That's unique in this fortunate or unfortunate 2-year history. He has been responsive. And I understand, Mr. Chief Justice, that is not how you do business here, and it's typically not how Mr. Reynolds does business. He'd like the opportunity to explain the failure to appear and the substantive issues.
Let's hear from your client, then. Mr. Reynolds.
Thank you. May it please the Court. First of all, I hold this Court in great respect, as I do the Disciplinary Committee. I've worked with Mr. Freeberg for some time and Mr. Nicholson, and I've tried my best over those proceedings to be forthright, provide all the materials and information necessary for them to make the decisions. I've tried to be cooperative in every way. I think we've had a decent rapport. What occurred in May and June, July, I can only explain. The first thing that was in my hands was on July 30th when I received a certified letter from the postal carrier who handed it to me. Prior to that, I have no doubt that the Disciplinary Committee was providing letters, but they were not anything that I personally received. I don't doubt that the letters that they say were sent, but they weren't in my possession until July 30th.
What does that mean? Did they come to your office and you didn't open your mail?
They came to a mailbox at the office, which is an office-sharing situation, and I didn't have them, and I don't have them. I didn't sign for any documents, according to the record, until July 30th, and that's when I first realized that this had happened. I was in Rapid City at my office on June 16th, or whatever the precise date was of that hearing, and if I had known that there was a hearing that date, believe me, I would have been there. Because I've been at every other hearing, and as Mr. Lowe said, I've gone to Chamberlain, so I sincerely apologize to the Court and to the Disciplinary Committee for causing this ruckus, but I want you to know none of this was intentional. I know it's important to take these things seriously, obviously. This is my livelihood, and I've devoted 20 years of my life to the practice of law, both in South Dakota and Illinois. I've done so up to recently with distinction, I believe.
But you were summoned, whether you got the notice or not, to come before the D Board because they basically, as I understand, Mr. Freeberg threw up their hands after repeated attempts to deal with your issues and decided that you were not capable of following through with these 60 agreements and everything else. So what do you have to say for yourself on the earlier allegations?
On the prior Disciplinary Committee proceedings? Well, Your Honor, I think if you look at the findings, and I don't want to sound defensive at all because I'm here, you know, really in the mercy of the Court, but I believe what they show is, honestly, a pattern of taking on some cases that probably no one else would take, doing a poor job of letting clients know when they have cases that can't possibly prevail, telling them that and being sympathetic to them and saying, well, we'll look at it from another angle then, we'll look at it from another angle. And both the JW and the EG instances, that's what those were.
Well, let me read you one sentence in the findings. It says, respondent, and that's you, failed to reply to Chris Palmer's directions regarding the EG file. He failed to do so until cited to appear before the board a third time. So apparently you're not only failing to respond to the board, you would come up with Mr. Palmer as a mentor, and you weren't even responding to him. Dog ate that, too?
I'm sorry.
Did the dog eat that, too?
No, Your Honor. The circumstances of that, and I think Mr. Palmer could attest to this, is apparently there was contact with EG to him, and he had contacted me while I was out of town for a period of weeks, and as soon as I received that, I contacted EG, and in fact, he and I went out to lunch together, and all was well after that. So I wasn't purposely trying to flaunt Mr. Palmer, who I picked as a mentor. I honestly wasn't. It was a situation where I was an island, essentially, working for Dunbar Enterprises, one person in an office, and was out of town for a period of time, and he was trying to call me. And as soon as I found out what was going on and what the lay of the land was and heard information from the Disciplinary Committee that Mr. EG was looking for me, I made contact with him. We sat down and we ironed everything out, and it was very pleasant.
Okay. Anything else you wish to say?
I apologize for being here. I believe I'm salvageable, and I'll do everything I can to make this work, whatever your recommendations would be. But I'm asking you to please consider the ramifications of this. I take what I've done very seriously, and I know I've made mistakes. I'm not here pounding the table saying that there's been an injustice against me that's been served here. I'm here hoping that we can make this work. I've appeared before this court many, 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 many times, and I think with distinction, and I hope to do so again.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, Mr. Freeburg, do you have a response? One question I'll maybe ask. What kind of notice do you give him in the hearing he says he never got?
I just looked at the transcript from the June 8th hearing. I got a certified mail receipt stamped at the post office in Burford on May 23, and I have a signed, you know, the green card that comes back and certified mail. I have a signed one. It's not dated, but I have one, and that was filed at the time of the hearing. It was noticed. But in addition to that, on April 25th, I sent a letter to Mr. Reynolds advising him that he wouldn't need to appear to save the date, so the board scheduled. We've been having some trouble with continuances, so we're trying to give people notice ahead of the formal notice. None of that mail ever came back to me. We've heard this before from him, you know. I couldn't find it, I didn't get it, I didn't get the message, I didn't get the mail. I read through all these transcripts and that I offered yesterday for these hearings, and I mean, that's the song that the board got, so you can understand why at some point that they took this unfortunate step of asking for a disbarment here.
Who signed that green card that you have?
Pardon me?
Who signed the green card?
I don't know. I can't read the signature on there. Justice Edwards, and it's the exhibit to the transcript, which was on file here in the court. If you'd like to look at it, I can't. It might be Arthur or Alta or something. I don't read it. But it came back to my office, and there was the same number as the receipt that I had stamped at the office. I have no reason to think he didn't have notice, for heaven's sakes. I would also point out to the court that the history that the counsel portrayed in the relationship between Mr. Reynolds and the board is inaccurate. It was not a willing appearance. It seemed that it was always cajoling, convincing, pulling him to come in, and then giving precisely the remarks that you heard here this morning. I'm sorry, I just didn't know. I've really been a good lawyer. I have this great record. I've done all these nice things, all of which may be true. But once this initial complaint was filed, he has not been either contrite or, frankly, forthright or cooperative with the board. And that's what these transcripts show, just beyond any doubt. The other thing that we have to recall is that none of these complaints were denied by Mr. Reynolds. I mean, he admitted he had a statute run in this first complaint we got. He admitted he had a conflict of interest. He admitted he knew better and didn't obey the rules. And we know that the Private 60 agreement does not dispose of that complaint, but rather it holds it in abeyance. And the agreement provides that if there's any violation of the agreement, the board can go back to the original complaint. We talked about E.G. in response to a question. You read the transcript about his relationship with Mr. Palmer and the E.G. matter. That was a simple thing that E.G. wanted his file. He wrote in October, he started calling to try to get his file. That's all he wanted. Well, it didn't show up, and it didn't show up. And Mr. Anna's explanation was he couldn't find the key for the storage bin. But you know what? When I served a subpoena on him for the next board hearing, he found the key in his desk drawer the next day. And that's what the transcript shows. So, it's, as I said at the outset, it's a puzzling circumstance. But I think my client, the board, was convinced that Mr. Reynolds should not be practicing law, that it's a danger to the public, to his clients, and it's just become kind of overwhelming. I hate to say that. I recognize the fine work he's done in the past, but something has gone awry, and my client's obligation is to say so, even though they don't like it. Any other questions, I'd be glad to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Freeberg.
Thank you,
Court will be in recess.